Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I'm delighted, actually, to welcome somebody I've known for a couple of decades now. We didn't realize back then that Tom Phelan is indeed a great writer, late bloomer, but you're very welcome to the program. How are you doing there, Tom Phelan?
Doing good, Adrian. And yes, I was a late bloomer. I was in my 50s when the first one came out.
Yeah. But you know, you couldn't have just picked up a pen one day. What were you doing, like, through the time, well, since the time that you were born in rural Ireland in County Leash, way back when, what were the first signs? What was the...
Well, I was always... I loved writing compositions in the national school. I'm sure you remember those.
I sure do.
Also then in school and in college, I used to write for the college magazine. But during all that time, I was reading, and I was always a very good reader.
Mm.
And we had an aunt who sent us birthday presents, and the birthday presents were books.
Really?
And, yes, our only birthday present. And we were always looked forward to them.
And where did she live?
She was a nun in Lucan in Dublin, a presentation
center. Yes.
Okay. And, but from the point of view of writing, I was more involved in, I guess, surviving for quite many years in my youth and trying to stay alive. And eventually I began to write. I was in Seattle University, actually, and we had to write a paper at the end of a course, and one of the Jesuits there asked me, did I ever consider writing seriously, you know, taking writing seriously. So from his encouraging words, I began. Mm-hmm. That's how it all began with me.
Your first book, The Season of the Daisies.
Yes.
I suppose that was one that drew a tremendous amount of attention. Just give us a synopsis on that one, because it's very closely related to not only Ireland but rural Ireland.
Well, it's about the killing of two boys. Of one boy who has a twin brother, and the twin brother witnesses the killing, and the killing was carried out by some so-called members of the IRA who were actually stealing, and they didn't want these two boys who saw them to tell on them, so they decided to kill them, and one of them got away, and the story then continues after that killing, how everybody in the village was affected by it, the covering up of it. And what was the end of the surviving boy about 30 or 40 years later?
Yeah.
And it did get very good reviews.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
How much of, going back to your youth, and you've traveled, you lived as a priest, you had actually lived and served in England.
That's right.
Spent some time in New York.
That's right.
And then having left the priesthood around whenever, that was 75 or 70, in the mid-70s anyway.
Yes.
You wound up in Seattle University then.
Yes.
Now, how did that come about?
Well, actually, I ended up in Seattle University just before I left the priesthood.
Yeah.
And I had gone there to do a degree in religious education. And by the time I left Seattle, I was also in the process of leaving the priesthood. So the degree wasn't that valuable to me.
Yeah.
And I never really used it at all in any way.
Now, Let me ask you, that bringing you to, again, your experience during those years, the lid hadn't blown off the pot, so to speak, with what was going to be a period in Ireland, very much focused on physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse, much of it way beyond the isolation of the clergy. There was a lot of that. I think most of us grew up in a very kind of, in hindsight, a very cruel kind of Ireland that I'd like to ask you, if you think that it was it enhanced by the clergy, or was there a theme there? Was the clergy, many would say, have taken a bad rap, particularly with the the industrial schools in Ireland, which in fact in one of your books, The Nailer. You brought out at a time before things got very widespread. You brought out some of the points that were many times well hidden in Ireland, which again is not it wouldn't have been that much different, I would say, in England and here. But you were a little bit ahead of your time in that sense, would you say?
Yes, and I don't know if you went to boarding school in Ireland.
I sure did.
Well, I think that the people around our age who went to boarding school, when I was in the seminary, I met guys from all over the country who had come through the diocesan high school, and listening to everybody talking, and this was only looking back on it years later, that within the diocesan high school, there was a sort of a taste of what went on in the industrial schools. There was a lot of cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
At least in my high school, and I know in Nathie's in Mayo, I have a close friend
right.
who went there. It wasn't overt cruelty, but it was almost a continual putting down of the students. There was no psychological help at all for anybody in any kind of trouble. There was no. The whole idea of a homeroom didn't exist. We were sort of put into this institution and said, these are the rules, and that was it. We never had contact at all with the teachers outside the classroom. And I think that the cruelty and the abuse that went on in the industrial schools was reflected in a way, in an obvious way, I think, in the high schools.
Right. Well, even in the national schools.
Yes.
That would be, say, the primary schools.
Yes.
There was a level of acceptance for physical abuse.
Yes.
That indeed would probably shock a great number of people, and yet that was. The accepted. That was pretty much accepted as well. Listen, this is good. It'll toughen you up because life is tough anyway. But then if you multiply that into the supposed security of the industrial schools, which was basically we think of industrial schools as somehow institutions, that grabbed a lot of those. We think of industrial schools pretty much only in terms of, young girls who got pregnant and you know, some of the highlights of that era are focused on that. But actually, industrial schools, maybe you can fill us in. They were, you know, they were permanent boarding schools. The difference between your high school and my high school was, it was, you know, you went to school and it was actually a privilege to go to a boarding school. I went to Mungret in Mungret College in Limerick, again the Jesuits, run by the Jesuits, and St. Nathie's that you, you know, you had mentioned there. A lot of my cousins went to the Durkins, went to Frank Durkin and his two brothers went to Nathie's. And that was a particularly rough, cruel school. Again, the diocesan schools.
The diocesan schools.
Yeah, but the tell us, just cross over though into the industrial schools, who were totally responsible. They were basically educational orphanages, or
yeah, they were basically technical schools. Supposedly, the idea was great, but the children who went in there, boys and girls, and the ones that I deal with in Naylor.
Yeah.
Were boys' school, and they were supposed to be taught a trade, like being a blacksmith, a carpenter, tailors, all that kind of
right.
thing. But that whole, and also they were supposed to receive the same level of education as children going to the national school outside. And this all fell through. And most of the things, all the abuse happened because the Department of Education was intimidated by the church.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said before about the cruelty within the national schools themselves, the parents were intimidated by the clergy. If you got whacked in school, in the national school, you didn't go home and say to your parent, oh, one of the teachers beat the crap out of you. Because your parents would beat the crap out of you because the parents believed the priests were right. And that they are the teachers, the Catholic
yeah.
teachers had this right to do this. And no one would ever, ever confront a nun or a teacher. And in that intimidation rose up through the ranks in the Catholic, in the whole country, in the civil
mm-hmm.
service.
Right.
It's amazing when you read all the books and the documents that came out of all these investigations, how intimidated everybody was by the church. When the inspectors from the Department of Education went to visit these industrial schools, they sent word in advance. So the brothers prepared a few rooms and put out some nice food and all that kind of stuff and dressed up some children and let the teachers, let the inspector see this kind of thing, and then the inspector went on his way.
Yeah.
And this is brought out in Naylor through a doctor, a medical doctor who was in charge of an industrial school, and he also allowed the brothers to intimidate him, and he wrote up false reports of the whole thing, and
yeah.
the children all suffered.
One would have to imagine, though, that, you know, where was the government? Ireland became a new republic,
yeah.
And allowing for the growing pains or whatever. How did the government pretty much hand over the education and the you know, the total running of these industrial schools? They pretty much washed their hands of it and said, okay, we'll definitely fund you to some degree,
yes.
But you're on your own.
Yes, I think this is all a power grab by the church. Remember, you know the history of the church in Ireland, how the church, like the recent, well, in the last 30 years, the role of the church in Poland rallied the people together, and it was the church around which the people rallied against communism. Well, in Ireland, the whole thing was against the British. The priest was the honored man in the parish.
Right.
He's the educated person. He was the authority. He could write, he could do wills, the whole thing. Now, when the English left, the priests held on to that power, which they no longer should have held on to.
Mm-hmm.
But the government was got in there. You have to remember that in those days, in the days of the young Irish Republic, there was still a lot of anti-Protestantism by Catholics and a lot of anti-Catholicism by Protestants, and each were trying to convert the other side. Now, I don't know if you ever came across this in a very overt kind of way, but the Catholic Church was afraid that if the children who went to these industrial schools, if they were left to the hands of the government, that eventually they would lose their faith, they would lose their souls, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the Catholic Church insisted that they offered the government this great, wonderful help of brothers and nuns who would work very cheaply for the government.
Right.
And they would run these institutions. At one point, there were 70 of them. And so you're talking about a lot of money here. So all the government had to do once the buildings were up was to pay these brothers and sisters and priests a per capita amount of money for each child present. The priests and the nuns, they were treated. Well, you know the way they were treated. They didn't get much money for all the work they did.
And indeed, for that matter, they didn't get a lot of credit because this was in response to a vocation. So they really didn't have much of a leg to stand on either.
No, and also a lot of the nuns and priests were recruited when they were children. They were 14. They hadn't developed into adults. They were put in charge of children who were hurting very badly. The children who came to the industrial schools were there because of family tragedies. They ran into people who had not had a chance to develop, and the only way to control the children was by brute force, and that's what happened. And the whole thing got out of hand. There was a lot of very bad beatings. There was a lot of sexual deviancy. It was just the whole thing was a disaster. And the main reason why, was because the Department of Education, which was in charge of the industrial schools, did nothing about it. Because they were intimidated by the church. Also, the government was afraid of, you remember Cardinal, or what was his name? The Archbishop of Dublin, McQuaid.
McQuaid, yeah.
They used to call Dublin the city in the shadow of the Archbishop's house because he had such control. And remember also the Catholic Church under McQuaid got control of the Catholic hospitals in Ireland. They were in charge of education in Ireland. And because they were in charge of education, they got to be in charge of the industrial schools. The people who were put into the industrial schools to take care of these children were not qualified at all. And, of course, abuses are wrong.
Now, your latest book in the book we'd like to talk about is The Canal Bridge.
Yes.
And it has been so positively reviewed by some of writers from Peter Quinn, for instance, to Frank... Howard Frank Mosher, to Kevin Baker, a lot of your fellow authors have given you credit for a different kind of writing. You seem to have, it comes easy to you to speak through a number of characters in your writing, and you have a talent for bringing those your own characters to become very, very live.
Yeah.
A lot of what you write about, though, is based on fact.
Yes. The story contains an enormous amount of facts. Actually, nearly every episode in the book is surrounded by a fact. And the fact may not be one that's well known. For instance, there's a situation where the word tank, the tank that the army uses,
right,
how that got its name. It's disguised when the Brodies, thanks to Europe for the first time, they disguised them on their canvases, and they told everybody they were water tanks. So ever since then, they became water tanks. And that little incident is at the center of one of these part of the stories that people tell.
Yeah.
And it has lots of little things like that. Like there's another one with Haig, Field Marshal Haig.
Right.
There's an incident around his being appointed to the Sudan years before, and when he went to the Sudan, he had a camel specially equipped to bring out his favorite claret with him, so he would be able to toast himself. And like there's lots of little unknown things like that. And rather than going into the you know, the big scale, trying to make a history of this, of the war in any way, I just picked on these small instances and associated them with the lives of the two main characters in the war, or
yeah,
with the girl that I leave behind, Kitty. And
yeah,
when you say, you know, writing seems to come easy, somebody said that some years ago, that writing seems to come easy to Tom Film, and, you know, it doesn't. It takes an awful lot of work, and part of the work is reading. I'm continually reading and continually reading poetry. I love the old English poets, John Milton.
Yeah.
You went through all those Wordsworth. All the old English guys that we had to learn in high school for the leaving. I love their language, and somehow over the years, that language comes back out through me in a different kind of way, but using their ideas and seeing how they set things or describe things, it's all in there, and when I'm writing, it comes out somehow.
You know,
I don't know how to explain
yeah,
the process, but when I'm sitting down writing it, it just comes out.
Friends, I'm talking with Tom Phelan, author of the latest book, The Canal Bridge, which brings us actually to, you know, what might have prompted you to write about World War One and how intertwined World War One was with Ireland and the effects of Ireland at a time when, in fact, Ireland was now becoming an independent republic.
Yeah.
How did that tie-in seep into your own writing and your psyche?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, the thing that started me writing, say, Naylor, was a visit to an industrial school where we found a little cemetery where boys were buried.
Mm-hmm.
That was the sort of the seed of that book. The seed of this book, The Canal Bridge, was my wife and I were coming through Manchester Airport one time on the 11th of November, and 11th of November was the day that the war stopped in Europe in 1918. And at 11 o'clock, an announcement was made. We were pulling our suitcases through the airport. An announcement was made. It is now 11 o'clock, and I was so terribly impressed by what happened that everybody in the airport stopped. And then I began to realize that it wasn't just in the airport, everybody throughout England was stopped.
Roughly what year are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
What year are you talking about, roughly?
Oh, about 10 years ago, I'd say.
Mm.
And while I was standing there with this 2 minute silence, I began to think of the old, I knew a whole lot of guys, I'm sure you did too, because the Mayo area sent an awful lot of guys to the war.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of the men that I knew as a child and how they were not honored the way the English were honoring their war dead. Now, it turns out that the 2 minutes of silence on the 11th of November is now extended to memorialize all the people who died defending England and who have died from terrorist attacks. But in Ireland, there was no such thing. And I began to think of these poor guys who came back from the war. Before they went to the war, they were laboring men.
Mm.
They went to make money. And when they came back from the war, they were laboring men. And they worked some of them worked on my father's farm. This is how I got to know them. And they were also pushed aside when they came back because, as everybody knows, the rebellion had happened in 1916. And the soldiers were who came back were accused of fighting on the wrong side. And
well, they were caught between a rock and a hard place.
They sure were. They were caught between a rock and a hard place. And what I tried to do, the more I read about the war, and my wife and I, we visited France and Belgium twice, you know, walking the battlefields and all that, and trying to get an idea of the place these men were, that, Oh, let me hear you.
That's, okay, well, something happened. No, don't worry about it. Keep
okay,
going.
And, when I started to read about these, and finally I found out that there were 220,000 Irishmen joined the war, fought in the war, 38,000 of them died, and nothing had been done about them. They were pushed to the edge of society. It was a very, very confusing time when they came back to the country, and they were not allowed to build a monument in the middle of Dublin to commemorate the fellows. Friends who had died, and they were pushed out to Island Bridge, and so that's where I started to write it. And as I wrote it, I began to see that these guys had gone to Europe at the behest of John Redmond. This is one of the reasons why they went. John Redmond persuaded the young men of Ireland to go and fight for England rather than stay at home and defend the home country, and said that if you go to England, go to Europe and fight with the English, you are fighting for home rule. And the guys from the north of Ireland, they went because they were fighting, they would be fighting against home rule and letting the British see that they were very loyal citizens and they did not want to be part of home rule. So John Redmond said, if you go to war and fight alongside these guys from the north, Catholics and Protestants side by side, and the common experience of war would help you all, help us all, to straighten out our difficulties when the war is over.
Yeah.
And which was a nice thing that Redmond hoped for. It didn't actually.
Now, who was Redmond, and where did how did he become so influential?
Well, John Redmond would have been the political successor of Charles Stuart Parnell, and he was the one who kept at it after Parnell had fallen from grace. And he had, in Parliament in Westminster, he was the leader of the Irish members of Parliament who were sent over there from Ireland. And he pushed through Home Rule Bill. The Home Rule Bill was signed in 1918, just after the war began, and it was put on the books, the law books. But they said that the implementation of it would take place when hostilities in Europe began.
Now, were over.
And, of course, that never happened because 1916 intervened and, you know, all that kind of thing. But anyhow, the point of the book was to equate the heroism of the First World War I soldiers with the heroism of the 1916 rebels.
Yeah, but your character, you know, seems to be... you know, it seems to be criticized across the board. I mean, there was no credit for anything. I mean, you know, maybe the excuse was whatever, you know, we'd have to come back to basics and say that in an impoverished country, those who left to go to the army were actually, they were doing that out of necessity. I don't think that anybody particularly thought, well, I'm going, you know, they taught, many of them looked at it as a means to support their families, to, it was a job.
Sure, it was a job, and we always forget, too, that early in 1914, the war began in August of 1914, around February 1914, the Great Dublin Lockout had just come to an end. And the lockout involved 30,000 non-laboring men. And the employees... employers had defeated them, they had actually reduced them to hunger and starvation. And the slums of Dublin were in a terrible state, poverty-wise. It was riddled, they were riddled with TB. And, of course, when the war came along, a lot of men in Dublin saw this as a great opportunity to make a living.
Yeah.
And this is why the women in Dublin, when the 1916 rebellion was over and the rebels were being led away to prison, that the women of Dublin from these slums came out and threw anything they could lay their hands on at them, because as far as they were concerned, they were undermining the jobs of their husbands in the trenches in the war in Europe. And another reason besides poverty was that the Catholic clergy pleaded with young men to go and fight the Germans because of their raping, you know, propaganda
right.
undergo here, the raping of nuns and the killing of children by the, you know, the savage Hun.
Yeah.
And so a lot responded to the clergy. A lot responded to Redmond. There was the poverty. That was a very big factor. There was also the sense of adventure. You know, you had the country full of all these young guys. They were all, a lot of them had no job. This is a great opportunity for adventure. A young guy, you know, to get to Europe, to see Europe. And they were all afraid that the war would be over before they got there. And then, of course, there were some people who were loyal to the English, whether you like it or not. There were a lot of
right.
people.
Well, they bear in mind that at that time, Ireland was under British rule.
Yes, it was.
And the notion of a republic and an independent Ireland was kicking around for a long time, but there was nothing.
No.
You know, it wasn't. You know, this was 1914.
Yeah.
And you know, so in hindsight, do you the youth characters and does the book The Canal Bridge, does it give, you know, in your mind, is are you balancing out the credit that should have been given, you know, with the actual facts? Are there? I know you've researched it tremendously. Was everybody kind of tainted with the same brush?
Well, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer. Ireland had been basically under occupation for about 700 or 800 years, whichever way you want to count it.
Right.
And over five or six or seven hundred years, people lose their own identity. Like, how many people listening to this program can tell you even the occupation of their grandfathers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, things go out of history very quickly. And the English had made a positive effort to eradicate education and Catholicism and the whole thing
yeah.
over the years in different forms. And eventually it got to a point where Thomas Davitt, the man who founded
right.
The Land League in Mayo, when he went to Mayo in the late 1800s to start a Land League, he discovered that there was no notion whatsoever of nationhood in Ireland.
Yeah.
He said that the people of Leinster were as foreign to the people of Connacht as were the French. So that whole idea of nationhood was gone. Like when people listen to Four Green Fields and all those old
yeah.
little songs, the people didn't think that way at those times. They were surviving. They had been occupied. It wasn't the British Army they were joining. They were joining the army.
Right.
You know, the
and as in, you know, again, fighting, you know, the trenches in Europe. It was it really didn't, I don't think that they were naive. However, it was, again, it was somewhat of an answer to the poverty and destitution which, you know, many would say in later years, you know, the Irish and their tendency, you know, towards immigration and the wanderlust and all of us, some of which you indeed address in your in the Canal Bridge.
Yeah, that whole idea of going out and going to other countries, joining the British Army was all part of that whole thing. It was just, this is the way they were.
Right.
There was the young people, they wanted adventure, they wanted broader horizons, and it was a means of escape, and to an escape into a better life.
You're coming back a little bit to yourself, having you know, gone to Seattle University, having then to reestablish yourself in America. This was, you know, you had worked in New York. You had worked. Did the whole aspect of growing up in Leash, having had the experience in England and indeed coming across the Atlantic, did much of that tend to lead you to become an author, to become a writer?
Yes, I think that, I definitely think if I had not left Ireland, if my parents had not sent me to high school, that I would never have had the opportunity to write. I don't think I would, if I'd stayed within the priesthood, I would have written anything. I think I would have become a very isolated and closed-off person. But as well as all having said that, I would have to say that when I was a child in Ireland, we lived in isolation.
Yeah.
Country farm was like, you know, you very seldom saw people beyond your school mate. It was an isolated way of living. I was isolated in high school. I was isolated in the seminary. And when I went to, when I became a priest, I was isolated within the priesthood, whether I liked it or not, whether it was my fault or whose fault it was, but people were inclined put the priest on a pedestal, and this is one thing I could not deal with at all, and I was really isolated within the priesthood as far as the world out there is concerned, but worldly experiences, and even when I went to England and worked there as a priest and came here and worked there as a priest, I was still isolated a lot. There was a lot of magical thinking involved in my way of seeing the world. When I went to Seattle, that did not help me to get into society, to grow up as a normal child, say, going to school here in this country and experiencing everything that they had experienced. I did not have that experience. I've always felt at a loss having been isolated that way. Also, by coming here and leaving Ireland, people said to me, well, why do you write about Ireland? Well, the reason why the stories are set in Ireland is because I know Ireland.
Yeah.
When I came here, I was, 30? And, you know, when you're writing, you have to know a lot of things, like the names of shrubs, bushes.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing. It's a whole, totally new experience. And
you have also... Tom Palin, you have also been around, you know, the Irish. You know, putting aside the isolation, that's very understandable. But even working in England, you were never that far away from, you know, the Irish, the emigrant in particular. The diaspora. So it's probably understandable. In hindsight, as you look at it, is there a common theme that you have picked up on a makeup, you know, of the Irish immigrants, and how different is that, say, between England and America?
Irish, or the most striking thing is the Irish in America are so proud of being Irish.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in England, this was in the 65 and all that, I was there for 5 years. The Irish were, well, I still, when I went to England, there were still little notices on the door, blacks and Irish need not apply. And I can understand why people put those up, because the people running these bed and breakfasts or these rooms, renting out these rooms, were mainly war widows. And they were trying to make a living by having rent in their house. And in I guess they didn't like the smell of the foreign food that the Caribbean people brought into the house with them. And they didn't like the Irish guys whose only social hangout was the pub. And they would, as I saw it myself, coming home drunk and fighting and breaking the furniture and vomiting all over the place. And here's this woman, this widow woman, trying to make a living. So, of course, she put up the sign, don't even try to get in here if you're Irish. I don't want you. And the Irish in England were seen as a little bit suspect, almost, by the English. And, well, that's a whole different history. It is a whole different thing. They tried to hide their Irishness in England. In here, they were proud of their Irishness. That tried over there to become, eventually, to become absorbed into society, so they would not be recognized as Irish, so they would be seen as British or English. And there was that huge difference.
Yeah.
And also, the opportunities offered in England were totally different and limiting in comparison to the opportunities that were offered here. You know, if you went to England with a a national school education, you weren't going to get too far unless you were very brilliant. But in this country, you know, even with a national school education, the opportunities to make money, if you had any brain, were there, and were there to be grabbed. You know.
And actually, that was not just for an isolated period. The America still offers that opportunity, I suppose, and that's very recognizable. The your book, your newest book. How do we get more information, and where can we get it?
Well, it's out in hardback. It was published by Arcade, and it's in bookstores, the major bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it is an e-book, and you can get it on your reader.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it is an audio book. A young man from Dublin did the audio book. He's an actor in the city, and that's how it can be got. And
now, can you put us onto website or something that will make it? I know that again, it's Arcade Publishing.
Yeah,
and which indeed is. An imprint of Skyhorse Publishing here in New York, and I do know that the website www.arcadepub.com, is that the best website, or do you have another one that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I have a website of my own, www.tomphelan.net. Yeah.
Okay.
Tom Phelan is all one word. Also, I just want to let you know that Arcade is also bringing out another book early next year called Lies the Mushroom Picker's Toe.
Okay. I want to again point out, particularly to our listeners, that Tom Phelan, you'd be feeling at home.
You're feeling at home, but I had a teacher who used to call me Feeling, and I hated him, and I decided I did not like anybody calling me Feeling.
Anyway, it is spelled P-H-E-L-A-N.
That's correct.
And friends, again, you can log on to my guest Tom Phelan's website, www.tomphelan.com. P-H-E-L-A-N, one word, .net.
That's right.
Good luck to you. Are you almost finished with your next
Yes.
Book?
Yes, I'm going through it, hopefully for the last time.
Terrific. Well, lots of luck to you. And, you know, it's for somebody who got out the gate late, you're catching up.
Well, thank you, Adrian.
Good luck to you.
Good talk to you. Goodbye.
Okay. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com.